Come, spellweavers, reavers, rogues, and men-at-arms, and answer the call of adventure. Pick up your sword, your axe, your spellbook, your bow, your rulebook, and your dice, and join the forces of good in their eternal fight against vile monsters, conspiring min-maxers, horny bards, and blood-soaked murder hobos. Discover the treasure trove of role-playing games here on Rollin' Bones. My name is Ryan Howard, and I shall be your guide. Good evening, boneheads, and welcome back to Rollin' Bones with Ryan Howard, where we are making old school young again. I am your host and king of the boneheads, Ryan Howard. I am the R in OSR, or some people say. And tonight's episode is going to be a barn burner. We are being invaded. It is the invasion from Planet X, and this is only the first phase. There's a second phase coming next week. But for tonight, Levi Combs and I are going to be discussing non-fantasy influences on role-playing games. So this is something I'm really excited to get into. So everyone remember to like, share, and subscribe if you want to see more of this. Tell your friends, tell your neighbors, tell your players, your GMs, and your mailmen that Rollin' Bones is your source for the best in all things RPG. And you can also find me on Twitter, Instagram. I am at Howard_RyanGreg on both. A lot of you guys have been finding me from Twitter, where I've been doing all these like RPG threads. I'm glad that you guys are enjoying those. I enjoy doing them. So, you know, keep liking, keep commenting, you know, giving me your feedback on those. I really appreciate that. You can also find me right here on YouTube. I am Rollin' Bones on YouTube. Just dropped a short form video today about defining RPG classes. So I'll be tweeting about that tomorrow. Hope you guys will watch that and, you know, give me some good feedback on that. And if you want to watch this on Twitch, you can find me at twitch.tv/RollinBonesRyan. And one last piece of my own shilling before I bring Levi on. I, of course, have the Bonehead Emporium over on TeePublic. I'm going to drop a link to that right now in the chat for all of you who are watching this live. And for those of you who are catching this after the fact, you can catch that in the comments below. It'll be pinned. So without further ado, I'll go ahead and bring this up right now because as Crafty Matt is pointing out here in the chat, Levi Combs has a brand new Kickstarter, Chainsaw Wizards, Hecktome Creeps, and Other Ungodly Bastards on Kickstarter. So ladies and gentlemen, the Grand Imperator of Planet X, Levi Combs.
Hey man, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm great, man. Well, you didn't like it. You didn't like Hecktome Creeps.
Hecktome Creeps. The problem is, I'm reading that after half a glass of bourbon, so some of those letters start to run together.
No, for sure, man. Maybe I need to get started myself.
Alrighty. Well, like I said, we are on here to talk about some non-fantasy influences on role-playing games because one of the really interesting things about D&D specifically, and then, you know, the fantasy RPGs that kind of come in and around D&D, from Go, there's a lot of genre bending. There's a lot of kind of blurred lines as far as what exactly the genre of this game is. There's some post-apocalyptic stuff. There, science fantasy shows up almost immediately. There's all kinds of weirdness around role-playing games, and it's because it wasn't inspired from one source or one particular genre. It was inspired from lots of different things.
Yeah, absolutely. Even when you go back in, like, into the early days of D&D, you have, you know, it's heavy in the sci-fi, you know, the genre, you know, mixing genre bending with fantasy. And Blackmoor, you know, that. You know, there's lasers and giant frogs and, you know, guys in armor with lasers riding giant frogs. You know, there's all kinds of you know, all kinds of cool little craziness in there. And it goes on to, you know, barrier peaks and all that other stuff. But yeah, it's there from an early day. Even like in, like we'll get to this next week with Arduin, but there's a lot of that in Arduin too, you know. And when you think about like all the stuff that was in Arduin and how that like informed so much stuff later on, like Rifts, for instance. You know, that whole the non-fantasy aspect of role-playing, like you were talking about genre bending, that really does come in really, really heavy.
And it's not a Planet X party without Metal Robot, aka Ed Bickford. Welcome, Ed.
Hey, Ed.
Supplying all of the giant robots for the invasion.
Oh yeah, Ed's a man.
And then Victor Gorchev, mixing guns and fantasy, not on my watch.
I love you. Well, to each their own, you know. I get it.
About that is Vic wrote Modern Necessities, which is OSE set in like modern times. Ah. So he's being ironic there.
Oh, excellent. All right. Like I said, to each their own, but I'm definitely in that camp that likes to mix a little bit of the weirdness into your traditional fantasy. Like I've had enough traditional fantasy, I think, probably for a couple lifetimes. So kind of almost, I don't want to say gonzo, but I do like it weird. I like that weird fantasy kind of sword and sorcery, almost like a Thundar kind of vibe, you know, where sometimes magic is indistinguishable from technology. I really like that aspect of things in my weird fantasy games.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, as we're kind of kicking off the discussion here of these non-fantasy influences, I want to kind of fence this conversation a little bit and ask you if certain things qualify as non-fantasy before we discuss them. So first and foremost, would you categorize Sword and Planet as a non-fantasy genre?
Well, okay, so it's definitely partially fantasy for sure. Are you talking about like John Carter and stuff like that?
Yeah.
Like Burroughs? Yeah, but there's so much sci-fi into it, though. Like, I mean, I guess when you get back to that whole question of like, not question, but like the whole thing about how science and technology, you know, are they indistinguishable from each other?
Right.
That's kind of a Burroughs sort of Sword and Planet thing. So I don't know. I say we throw it in there. Like, why not? You know, let's count those. Not so much as fantasy, but like as their own thing, like as Sword and Planet.
Yeah. I'd actually agree with you. And I think Sword and Planet is kind of a good gateway into the genre bending that role-playing games did from Go, because so many of them were reading Burroughs, you know, the Princess of Mars in particular, you know, so many, there's so much influence just from that series, the John Carter stories. I feel like that has to be included in the discussion.
Oh, 100%. 100%. Yeah, I'm right there with you.
And then the other thing, and this is a big one.
All right.
Would you include Lovecraft as non-fantasy?
Well, so that's the thing about Lovecraft is some of his stuff isn't fantastic at all. But some of it is really fantastic, like all the, you know, all that the Dreamland stuff. That's all, you know, all that stuff that he gets that comes from Algernon and Blackwood and Dunsany and all those other guys. Like that stuff is really fantastic. But I would categorize it more into weird fantasy than just like straight up fantasy. Gotcha. But then you got half a love, not even half, more than half of Lovecraft is just pure horror, you know, just supernatural fiction. So yeah, I don't think Lovecraft fits the bill at all. And the same would go with some of Robert E. Howard's stuff, you know, because he wrote some he wrote all kinds of, you know, pulp yarns, but he wrote some really good horror tales, too. Like one of the best horror tales, Pigeons from Hell. So you know, he's got a lot of horror stuff too. So I think it's safe to not include them and just say they're kind of their own thing.
Yeah.
obviously, you know, when we think of traditional fantasy, we're thinking, you know, like a lot of the appendix end stuff, you know, a lot of Tolkien and all that, you know, all kind of stuff, you know, Three Hearts and Three Lions and Companions of the Flame and all that Robert Silverberg stuff. But like, you know, there's quite a bit of it that's just kind of offbeat and strange too. Like the, even Michael Moorcock a little bit. Some of that stuff is, it's fantasy, but like, it's pretty weird. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? So,
and even in like Conan, which is very, like, people think of it as very much like, this is fantasy. Conan is medieval fantasy or pre-medieval, however you, it fits in the fantasy genre. But Tower of the Elephant, by the end of that story, he's talking about like space aliens and stuff. So,
right. Yeah. And again, that's real sword and sorcery kind of stuff. Which again, really borders on, you know, there's like traditional fantasy, sword and sorcery, and then like weird fantasy. And that sword and sorcery and those, that weird fantasy can really kind of cross over, you know, quite a bit. So I'm with you on that. Let's take it by a case by case basis.
Gotcha. So Crafty points out something here in chat. Lawrence of Arabia, The Matter of France, and tons of World War II history, battles, and politics. This brings up one of the first ones that I wanted to talk about. And this is the war adventure movie genre. Mm. Because, and this is something I kind of had to wrap my brain around as a millennial, someone who very much did not grow up in this era of pop culture that we'll be talking about tonight. But from 1949 to about 1967, even into the 70s, the like predominant genre of action adventure movies was like World War II films.
Mm. Yeah.
So you get these movies like The Great Escape, The Dirty Dozen, Kelly's Heroes, mm-hmm. which present this kind of ragtag group of miscreants banding together to go on suicide missions. And I feel like that dynamic is just hard coded into role playing games.
Oh yeah, I mean, well, you know, any kind of like, what about the Seven Samurai? You know, like where you have a bunch of different personalities and they come together for a common goal. That is 1,000% like baked right into to RPGs. You know, almost really from the get go. I mean, I it makes me kind of wonder, like, what were they thinking? You know, like when it went from like the chainmail rules, you know, on over into the, you know, where they started like less wargaming, more like dungeon exploring, and more like, you know, where you had individual characters rather than armies. Like, I wonder, like, what sometimes I wonder what their influences were. Like, you know that they grew up on those shows, you know, all the founders, they grew up on those movies, and they had those influences. We have Appendix N, the show, you know, where Gary's head was about things, at least partially. But you got to wonder about, like, what were those other, like, what were the other pop culture references? Like, did music did it have a part in it? Movies for sure, but like, you know, comics of the time, like we know EC Comics had a bit of an effect on Gary, but it really makes you think, like, or kind of wonder, like, on a broader scope, like outside of the things we expect, you know, comics and movies and magazines and TV shows, like, really where were those influences? Like this is going to be a good talk. This is going to be a good one. I can feel it coming.
Yeah. I mean, like music is an interesting one that you bring up there, because right around this time, this is when prog is really booming, is right in the midst of the D&D emergence when, you know, Genesis in their prog phase and Rush are really taking off. Pink Floyd is humongous. So, and, again, to, you know, the Venn diagram of prog listeners and role-playing enthusiasts, it's very, like, there's a lot of overlap there. I'll put it that way. I do think music does have a lot to do with that.
No, and I think that just carries on to now. Like, even now, it's the same thing. Like my oldest son, he listens to King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard. if I cut all that out. And he says, yeah, you know, their roots kind of come from Rush and kind of from that whole prog movement into what they're doing now. And they said that's what he and his friends are listening to, you know. Like for my age group, it was like, you know, you were rolling your dice on the cover of you know, Dark Side of the Moon, but you know, your brother might have like rolled a joint there like 5 seconds before that, you know what I'm saying? So it's like that whole era is kind of like for me in my head are kind of intertwined. And just like for him, like when he and his friends play, you know, they're listening to different music but it all kind of like, if you take it all the way back to the source code, back to that prog movement, I bet you find again, a lot in common, a lot where things cross over.
Yep. Oh, we got John Page in the house, the composer himself.
Hey, there we go.
Absolutely. John Page did my theme song, and he's a good friend of mine. So welcome, John.
Good job.
Glad you were able to make it.
It's tight, man.
Now, another thing, kind of back on the subject of the pop culture and the action cinema of that era that Gary and a lot of the early pioneers grew up in, another sure. one that I wanted to mention was Westerns.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, you couldn't you trip over a Western back in those days. Like, yeah. You couldn't move 5 feet without falling over one. They were everywhere. That was the, like, for my dad, all the stuff that he was watching in the 70s, it was either detective stories or war, or like a war movie, or and mostly Westerns. You know, it wasn't even that, like, Corbucci spaghetti Western stuff. It was like the John Wayne. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like the Bonanza, Big Valley kind of stuff. You know, that was what he was watching all the time. Mm-hmm. You know.
Oh yeah, my grandpa was the same way. Every time I went over there, he was either watching a Western or we were talking about Westerns.
Makes sense.
And it was like he liked Clint Eastwood, but it was always John Wayne or Shane. Or, you know, something of kind of that variety.
Man, people forget how big John Wayne was, man. Oh, yeah. He was a superstar. He was the man. He was the Leonardo DiCaprio, Brad Pitt of his era. You know, as far as star power, he was another one of those guys that was just so intertwined with the genre. Both war movies, you know, Green Berets, and you know. All the stuff that he was in, and then Westerns as well. So like he was intertwined with both those genres. And you have to think like those guys, when they were, you know, the early founders, the guys, you know, Gary and, you know, all the guys that were putting in all the hard work early on, you had to think that they were watching that stuff. That had to be a factor.
Yeah, absolutely. Joe George in the house.
Hey, Joe.
Randolph Scott is one of the unsung heroes of the Western. I will give it to your mom there. And then John Crazy. Page again. Sergio Leone is a god. I agree with that.
Yeah.
And give me a call. When you're doing the spaghetti Western fantasy hybrid piece, because I don't know if that's just a music piece or if you're planning on doing more with that, but if you're doing one of your audio comics around spaghetti Western fantasy hybrid, you know where to find me, John.
Yeah, Leone and Corbucci. I mean, I can't really think of anybody who does that spaghetti Western genre. That whole like mysterious man comes into town and kind of wrecks shop, sort of, or like revenge tale set in the Western frame. Like there's not really anybody other than those two guys that does it better. Mm-hmm. They're kind of like the pinnacle, I think, when it comes to those genres and those specific kind of stories.
Mm-hmm.
Which again relates to role playing, because you know how many times is a mysterious man or you know guy blows into town or the adventurer, the game starts out with the adventurers coming into a town that's been you know, that has some sort of mysterious secret, or, you know, there's is blockaded or overtaken by, you know, some nefarious force. Like, again, all of it hardwired, hard baked right into it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, think about Seven Samurai, The Magnificent Seven, High Plains Drifter, and then think about what Keep on the Borderlands is.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you make a very good point. You know?
Yeah. You can see it right there, because you arrive in this town that's right next to something completely, like, dangerous happening. And, you know, there's treachery within the town. It's all kind of just right there. It's right there in the open, but it's not so obvious that you're like, hey, that's ripping off right. Magnificent Seven. Because, I mean, that's a gigantic movie. And people would notice.
Well, a lot of those early modules had that too. Like, you got Sinister Secret of Salt Marsh with the Thieves Guild, and you've got Village of Hamlet with the Moat House. You know, which if you follow that thread, you know, it turns into like just mega campaign. You know, but yeah, that's a great point. It really does translate over.
Mm-hmm. And Joe George again. If you want a standard Western game, John Torres, the basic expert, has a great game called Cowpunchers that you should look into. So if you're looking for a modern system that's, you know, just standard Western fare, old school adjacent, Cowpunchers is the way to go on that.
I love a good Western game. It didn't even have to be weird Western. I mean, I like Weird Frontiers and Dark Trails and all that, you know, all that, Deadlands and all that kind of stuff. But, and I actually prefer it, but, I love a good Wild West game, just as much. I've been trying to get into Alan Hammock's, Boot Hill game for a couple years now, but we always end up running games at the same time. So I can't
get into those games. Same thing happened to me this year. I wanted that game and it didn't work out.
Yeah. It's, you know, because if you're gonna play Boot Hill, who better to play with an Alan Hammock? I mean, come on, you know, like, what a master.
Now, another kind of 800-pound gorilla in the room that we have to talk about with non-fantasy influences is Dune.
All right. Here, sell me on this Dune connection.
Okay. So
what makes Dune so important to the non-fantasy? Because that's another one of those ones that kind of borders on fantasy, but not so much as like Barsoom or anything. But like a lot of fantastic elements to Dune. So, but I'm here for it. I'm all ears.
So, I've been kind of digging into a lot of the patron play and strongholds and like essentially the higher level end of old school D&D, where you build yourself a stronghold and you start amassing an army and essentially become a power player in your campaign world. And when it comes to understanding political intrigue and building an army, amassing kind of your fiefdom, and becoming a force to be reckoned with in your campaign world, Dune is essentially your Bible for that.
Okay. I mean, not everybody can be the Quizzatch Haderach, but right. fair enough. I always kind of felt like it was more like, like Zelazny's Amber series, you know? Okay. Like that had a better correlation to what you're talking about, but I can see it with Dune. Like, because he really does go from being kind of like this, you know, young prince to, you know, being the, you know, the guy who raises an army that decimates the, you know, universe.
But even like, again, the big thing with Dune, it's the political intrigue, but you can also see in the various main characters of Dune, this is what a high level thief ends up doing in D&D. You become the master of assassins. You know, this is what a high level bard becomes. Gurney Halleck. A high level warrior becomes either Leto Atreides if they're, you know, good, or Baron Harkonnen if they're evil.
Yeah, I hear you, man. And I can see all that. Definitely for the political side of role playing, 100% with Dune, because I mean there's not many that of the of that era that do it better than Dune did it. Especially those when you take those three books together and you have all the ins and outs and things go sideways and you have all these, the Bene Gesserit are doing their thing in the background and they have the long game of all these, thousands of years. Yeah, man. Yeah, that really is, as far as the politics angle of that goes. No, for sure. For sure.
And then, like, you can also see the influence of Dune on something like Dark Sun, and that I'm a huge Dark Sun fan, so.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, yeah, we got to talk about Dark Sun sometime because I'm not as big a fan of it as you were, but man, it was so different than anything else that came. It's like they took all the, like, I think I've said this to you before, they took all the bad ideas that didn't work in normal D&D and they kind of put them in Dark Sun and put them together, and
Yes.
somehow they all worked well together. Like, all right, well, psionics are a bit difficult and kind of problematic and during play for normal D&D, they kind of a game breaker, but now we're going to take them and we're going to give them to everybody. Everyone has psionics. There's lots of dragons in normal D&D. Now there's going to be one dragon. It's like the halflings are cannibals. Let's make Thrycreen and monsters and half giants and it's such a gonzo, not gonzo is the wrong word. It's such just a crazy setting that it's kind of brilliant in the fact that it all works and it's all so much fun to play, you know.
And ladies and gentlemen, we are in the presence of greatness this evening. Jim Wampler, you're really talking
Yay!
about the how-tos of world building, so Dune is a great template. I thank you, Jim. I appreciate that. And thank you for watching. So I feel like I've monopolized the conversation here for a little bit. So I want to throw it to you and just, throw out some of the stuff that you've been thinking about as far as non-fantasy influences.
Oh, well, I mean, I had a couple, like I was telling you before the show, it's like there's broad stroke stuff and then there's really like specific things. And for broad stroke stuff, like I can't help but think that like improv theater was a big part of what made D&D, like that whole movement is a big part of what made D&D, as far as role playing in general, what that's, that's almost like a genesis for it. And then of course you've got stuff like modern history, ancient history, mythology. There's, going all the way into like pulp fiction from the 20s and 30s, early 40s. Like so much of that like is ingrained in like the early DNA of D&D especially, but in role playing in general. But yeah, which one did you want to do? Are you talking broad strokes? Are you talking like more specific?
Go specific here for just a little bit, because I want to see kind of if we've been thinking on the same track in some of these.
Okay. Well, there's what is, there's stuff that has inspired my own games, and then there's stuff that has just kind of in a broad stroke sense of inspiring the role playing in general. Like for certain, like horror and sci-fi, like we were talking about Lovecraft and Robert E. Howard earlier, and those horror stories and how they for sure they can be fantastical, the Dreamland stuff with the Randolph Carter stuff. But yeah, man, 100% on the horror vibe. I mean, they've inspired whole, multi-million-dollar games. You wouldn't have Call of Cthulhu without, without Lovecraft. You wouldn't really have much supernatural fiction at all without him kind of jump-starting the gun there. And then he got kind of his reemergence in the 60s and 70s where, all these authors were just, rediscovering him and kind of holding him up, He was finally getting his due long after his death, And the same with Robert E. Howard, like his horror stuff is fascinating. Like again, he wrote one of the best, in my opinion, one of the best horror stories of the pulp era, which was Pigeons from Hell. But he did the other, he did the, was it the Black Stone? Maybe I'm getting the name wrong on that one. But he's got a whole, a bunch of stuff. Even this like the Solomon Kane stuff too. like where the one where Solomon Kane fights the werewolf, and then there's the one with the voodoo one, and then, you know, all that stuff is just fascinating. Which reminds me, I need to go back and read those because I'm a huge Howard fan. We've talked about this at length, you and I. So you know, but yeah, for sure horror, and then you can go into like sci-fi, and not even like retro sci-fi. If you go deep into it, you've got stuff like Philip Jose Farmer. He did the River World and the World of Tears settings, and those are less like less fantastic. That's all Appendix N stuff, or at least Appendix N adjacent. There's of course Burroughs. We talked about him. What about steampunk? And that whole retro futurism, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say like Sky Captain and the World of Tomorrow kind of stuff, but like that whole like atomic age kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, would we even have Eberron if it wasn't for that stuff?
Probably not. Yeah, I mean, and this is getting kind of more into like modern role-playing games, which is, you know, fine. But yeah, I mean, steampunk is kind of a big influence on definitely like modern role-playing games. And even if you want, if we're going down that route, the Thief series in particular is where I think a lot of people of the generation right before mine and my generation kind of first encounter steampunk as a genre. And then real quick here, Victor Gorchev, I am not one of Howard's descendants. He does not have descendants because of how he died. I am a relative, but yes, it is a shame about me. So,
well, yeah, I mean, when you get to the steampunk and that kind of retrofuturism stuff, there's also like Around the World in 80 Days.
Yeah.
And gosh, what's the other one? Not Willy Wonka. I get my wires crossed on them. What is that other one? We'll have to go back to it. It'll kick in my head here in a minute, but yeah, there's a whole bunch of those like where the invention is king, you know, and they have like the tubes and the you know, the crazy inventions and the long stilts and the goggles and the whole nine yards. So a bunch of those. Wizard of Oz, for instance, that's another one. Like all that kind of stuff. I don't think you get like an Eberron series without that stuff kind of laying the groundwork, or like a Castle Falkenstein. That was another game from the 90s that I thought was great, but it really just didn't catch on. That's another one that is really steampunk, you know, that's got that real kind of alternate futurism sort of vibe to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I guess while we're on the subject of steampunk, H.G. Wells, his novels are obviously very influential on role playing, like, you know, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, I think, is a big one. But the funny thing about H.G. Wells, he's influential on the concepts, but he's also influential on the rules, because he wrote Little Wars, which was one of the things that kind of codified wargaming in his era. It was kind of the late 19th, early 20th century revival of role-playing came out of H.G. Wells' Little Wars rules. Nice. So, you know, from there, he kind of works on both sides of the inspiration circle in a weird way.
All right. No, H.G. Wells is who I was thinking of earlier, like with War of the Worlds and the Time Machine and things like that. That's who I was trying to think of, and I was like, "Who's the other guy? Who was that?" It was Wells.
And then Scott Orcus Dorcas asks a good question here. What was a young Levi renting from the local corner VHS store for non-fantasy inspiration?
Oh man! So in my small little town of like 5,000 people, there were two video stores, and the one closest to me was like the smaller one. It was kind of like the poor people's video store, you know, where things were like half price what they were a little bit uptown. Mm-hmm. But it, for me, it always, like going back, it was always monster movies, and science fiction. It depends on how far back you go, because like at first it was like I'm reading, you know, episodes of He-Man, you know, or like I'm trying to get like Transformers, a couple episodes of that on a VHS. If you go back far enough, it was Star Wars on Laserdisc for like my, you know, seventh birthday. I was just out of my mind. We watched it like 9 times that weekend, you know. And my dad was like, "Enough of the Star Wars. I don't care if it's your birthday." But as I got older, like 12, 13, and started getting to D&D, it was almost always like horror films. It was that whole canon era of, so I was 13, I was, it was like 87, 86. So yeah. So like I was really into like ninja movies and like Chud or like, you know, whatever was playing like on Showtime, like after 11 o'clock at night, and I was staying up late to watch. It was that kind of stuff.
A big fan of Reb Brown's career.
Oh yeah, man, dude, all over old Reb. Man, that's a deep cut. Yeah, there's so many of those. I guess that's where my love of like B movies and grindhouse stuff comes from in general, is from that era. Is like that's kind of where it started, and just kind of developed into kind of all these different offshoots, but. Yeah, anything with a ninja in it, anything with like a mutated monster, or anything with like, you know, a roving pack of vampires or zombies or any kind of like supernatural possession or like a demon movie or something like that. I mean, I was all about it. I was that kid at like the farmer co-op, like sitting on the bag of dog food reading an issue of Fangoria. So I was like, all about Freddy Krueger, all about, you know, Jason Voorhees, but at the same time, like still fascinated with like Universal Monsters and Hammer Horror and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. Really anything horror, you know, anytime like where horror and pop culture kind of crossed in the 80s, I was all about that. And let's not forget comic books, because I was just a complete comic book nerd. Still am pretty much, but, yeah, all that stuff kind of intersected to inform my choices at the old video store.
Now, before we get on to comic books, because that's one that I definitely want to talk about, staying on the subject of B-movies, a mutual love that we share would be for the what used to be called the Hop and Shop movie, the Shaw Brothers Kung Fu movie.
Oh, man. Let's get started.
I mean, like, the 36th Chamber of Shaolin is a classic.
It's my favorite kung fu movie.
Absolutely. It's a banger. But what I think a lot of people don't realize, when they look at what kind of like the modern fantasy classes are, the monk is included amongst those. And a lot of people don't ask why the monk, which is generally kind of couched in an Eastern mythology, is here included with a whole bunch of, you know, Western European fantasy. And the reason why is role-playing games were created in the 70s, and in the 70s, Kung Fu was king.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, especially like in the inner city or any kind of urban area or like a densely populated area, Kung Fu movies were huge because the grindhouses could show them cheaply. They could get these movies from China or Japan, sometimes from the Philippines. They could get them really, really cheap, and then they would just show them just back to back with other kung fu flicks. And they, you know, they would just pack the house, you know, full. And these movies sometimes would show for just, you know, back to back to back 24 hours in some of the grindhouses for just months on end. And you know, I'm glad you said this, because I never really thought about the connection between the D&D monk and like Shaw Brothers films or the whole Shaw era. But like when I start thinking about first edition monk abilities, you know, I start thinking about it. I'm like, these are all stuff that you could find in, you know, classic kung fu movies from that era. You know, I mean, honestly, I mean, everything from the Withering Palm or whatever it is, the one that stops the heartbeat, that's straight out of Street Fighter, man.
Yeah.
Like that's, you know, they go on to, of course, later on with Kill Bill, and they do the five finger exploding heart technique or whatever.
Yeah.
But I mean, that stuff, you could trace all that back to like the Venom mob movies. And man, there's so much stuff, like the flying guillotine with the hat and the, oh man, we could go deep. Yeah. We could go deep on this one.
But the thing about the monk, so you look at all the other classes and you can see where like the inspiration, you know, the fighter, someone wants to be Conan, someone wants to be Fawford. When the thief comes in, someone wants to be the Grey Mouser.
Sure.
You know, wizards, there's all kinds of wizards you can point to, clerics as well, monks. The monk shows up in, I believe in 1975 is the first published appearance of the monk. What's one of the biggest shows on TV at the time?
Kung Fu.
Kung Fu. Yeah. Someone wanted to be Kwai Chang Kane and Gary.
Well, and the year after Bruce Lee dies too. Yeah. You know, Bruce Lee was, I mean, mega famous as you could get. So yeah, that's like right after, if it comes out in 75, it's right after he dies. Mm-hmm. 'Cause he dies at 74, late 73, one of those, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly. But yeah, like, even more so, like, what is the highest rank a monk can get? Isn't it like the Master of Flowers or something?
Yeah.
It's one of the ranks. But like that translates right to like the White Lotus, you know, be the Pai Mai, the Master of the White Lotus, you know, that, like literally I'm just now seeing it. Like that's a direct connection, because why else would you call him the Master of Flowers if you weren't watching, you know, those White Lotus movies where with the character of Pai Mei, the venerable Kung Fu master on the desolate mountain, you know, who's gone up to the top of the mountain to ponder life and its mysteries, you know. That's so literal. I'm so glad that you brought that up. I will never look at first edition D&D and Kung Fu movies in a connection like that the same again. That's that's very interesting. You got my mind reeling now.
And to tie back into what you were saying about the grindhouses, to answer questions that people might have about something in comics, those grindhouses not only would show Kung Fu movies, they would also show blaxploitation movies like Shaft and Superfly and stuff like that. And so when you combine Kung Fu movies with blaxploitation movies, this is where Power Man and Iron Fist end up being a natural pair for each other.
Yeah, most definitely. That's a really good point. Yeah, those are both definite. They are definite characters that were paired together for a specific reason, and that's it. That's very astute, man. That's really. I never even thought about that, but you're absolutely 100% right. Man, you got me rethinking some stuff now. And I love Power Man and Iron Fist. I still a fan. I was a big fan of like Shang-Chi. There was a whole like revolution in the 70s in Marvel Comics. And Jim, if you're still listening, you'll know what I'm talking about. But like they did like monsters suddenly got really, really like they were the main characters in their own books. You had Tomb of Dracula and the Living Mummy and it was the Curse of the Werewolf. Yeah, I mean there was a Frankenstein book, the Ghost Rider. You know, all these, there's like a whole legion of monsters thing, the Man Thing. These were all like big. Big time. That was, they were really, really popular. And then along with that, like that horror aspect, you had like, again, you could go into like Power Man, like Luke Cage books, but really Shang-Chi was huge. Like, especially like that first, like, I don't know, like 60, 70 issues. It was really, really like the whole thing about like Shang-Chi is trying to, he's trying to face off against his father, Fu Manchu. You know, it's like it was so typical of like any like an episode of Kung Fu or Enter the Dragon or you know it was the traveling Kung Fu master who would eventually one day have to face off against his father. You know, it's just so God, so grindhousey, and I can't believe until this conversation that I'm not putting those two and two together. Fascinating.
Well, and with a lot of this stuff, you also have like the paperbacks of the era. So like one of the big inspirations that Arneson and Gygax cited were the Destroyer novels, the Remo Williams novels. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. Those Remo Williams stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess so. I had no idea that they were reading those. I'd never heard of that before, but it makes sense, you know, because those, I mean, they could devour one of those books in an afternoon,
yeah.
You know, and there were like 100 of them, you know, like, you know, so you can go to bookstores today and still find them, you know, and that was, you know, 50 years ago. So yeah. Yeah. No surprise there. Now that I think I put a little thought to it, there's no surprise there. And there's so much of that cool stuff in those Remo Williams, books. Because he was, you can imagine, that's like solo play, you know?
Yeah. and Jim Wampler points out that Roy Thomas was reading these paperbacks at the same time that Gary was. So this is where, like, the Conan appreciation comes in.
Right.
And then another one that that Victor and Joe are pointing out here in chat, the Executioner, Mac Bolan. Without him, we don't have the Punisher, which I love both the Executioner and the Punisher. For sure. So.
Yeah, for sure. Wasn't the Punisher right around that Death Wish era too, where it was like the common man rising up against crime in the city and like doling out punishment or like getting back at the criminals?
Yeah, Mac Bolan and the Death Wish and Taxi Driver all kind of show up at the same time.
Yeah,
and Punisher is very much born out of that as well. That post-Vietnam 70s recession anger at, like, you know, these are the circumstances that we find ourselves in. Our streets are completely overrun with crime.
Yeah.
There
was there's some grindhouse films too that fall into that category. There's Rolling Thunder. It's all usually about a Vietnam vet coming back, you know, from the war and finding that his city is, you know, just in the dumps, or just overrun with crime, and him fighting back. Billy Jack. It's not Executioner, the Exterminator. There's a whole Exterminator series. You'll know him like when you see him, because it's like a guy in like a welding mask. He's got like a battle jacket on and a big flamethrower on the cover, you know. like every single one of the that and the sequels are all kind of him in a different pose. But you know, him lighting, you know, he's got his flamethrower that he somehow brought back with him from Vietnam, and he's lighting these pimps and muggers and whatnot on fire. Just utter ridiculousness. But how is that any different from a wand of fireballs when you kind of really think about it?
Right. Now, we've talked a little bit about comics, but there's two particular artists who I want to kind of shout out as being big influences on D&D. And the first one is Jack Kirby, because Jack Kirby is influential on everything. But I do feel like there's, in a lot of the kind of like the big evils that show up and the kind of Norse influence that you see in a lot of it, a lot of that comes from Kirby's Thor.
Sure.
And then the other one along the same lines, and this is getting more into the 80s, more into the AD&D first edition and even into second edition, Walt Simonson.
Oh, well, but yeah, both those guys, you know, some of their landmark stuff was on Thor. You know, that I had all the, like you were saying, had all of the you know, all that medieval or, you know, Norse aspects to it, you know, lots of swords and hammers and armor and fantastic creatures and dragons and stuff. So all that makes sense. But even when you can go a step further, especially with Kirby. I mean, first of all, Kirby's the only guy who can draw dots and they look cool.
Yeah.
Like just random multicolored Kirby dots, you know, like he is such a landmark. Like he's the GOAT. Like he's the best. Like he's the guy. Like if you were to take a poll, I think probably if you took a poll of all of the comic book artists working today and you say, who is the most influential comic book artist? And there's going to be a couple guys there in the mix, but I think the common aggregate is going to be Jack Kirby. Like who doesn't look at that guy and go like, yeah, he's the GOAT. Think about all the stuff that he did with like Fantastic Four, all that Villain of the Week stuff. Like you've got Galactus, you've got the Destroyer, you got the Mole Men and the Moloids, you know, plus Fing Fang Foom and all these, you know, all these, you know, even down like the Impossible Man, like it's so silly, you know. He really, man, Yeah, Kirby really was the man. Really, you want to talk Kirby, you should get Jim on the show. Like, he's the guy to talk to Kirby about. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love Kirby, man, but Jim takes it to a new level. Like, he's got the info. He's the man on Kirby. Mm-hmm. Simonson, he's a master. I guess really until recently, in the last like 10, 15 years, like Simonson had the best run of Thor probably ever, you know, and still might be up there for contender number one. Certainly one of the ones that gets stolen from the most as far as like the stuff that goes into the MCU.
Yep.
But I think, was it Michael Oeming had a really good run with Thor? But yeah, man, Simonson was it visually and story wise was just, he's another just legend. Mm-hmm.
And even and I mean, this gets kind of back into the martial arts stuff that we talked about, but like Frank Miller, I think, is also pretty influential on the 80s stuff. Because again, like that's right in the middle of the Ninja Turtles, Ninja Craze. We might have to do a whole separate episode just on this topic alone. I have a theory about the martial arts craze.
Okay.
In that it came in waves. So this is just real quick, my thesis on the U.S.'s fascination with martial arts. Wave one begins in 1946 as the GIs are coming home and they're bringing karate back from Japan and Okinawa with them, because you know they were taught karate originally by the Okinawan masters while they were stationed there.
It tracks, yeah, okay.
And along with that comes kind of the first wave of these people who are claiming they're ninjutsu masters, because they're coming back again from Okinawa and Korea and you know trying to sell ads and comic books. Then you get into the Bruce Count Lee. Dante. Yeah, Count Dante, exactly. And so, like, but he comes in right around the time that Bruce Lee gets real big, and you start getting the Green Hornet on TV, and you know Burt Ward from the original Batman series is a karate black belt. So you're seeing martial arts TV shows and movies, and this gets you into the second wave, which
don't forget James Bond. James Bond had some martial arts in it as well. Mm-hmm.
And so that's the late 60s, early 70s. It ebbs off from there, and then it picks back up again in the early 80s with Frank Miller's Daredevil, Ninja Turtles, and then it peaks in 1984 when The Karate Kid is released.
Oh, yeah. You can't not throw in the ninja craze of the 80s, though. That was so big. And that came like right on the heels of Karate Kid. You couldn't go to the supermarket without seeing like four ninja magazines. You know, it was on the cover of Black Belt. There was like Inside Kung Fu. There was a ninja magazine. Oh, but there was like a ninja comic book. But that mixed with Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and then all that stuff that like you're talking about Frank Miller. He did that whole Daredevil run where it was like all ninjas and Elektra and the Hand and Bullseye. That whole like 60, 70 issue run. Which still to this day holds up pretty well. I mean, there's some issues in there that are like, you know. But the high point stuff, like the death of Elektra, the whole battle with the Hand, that's all still like heavy. They're still mining that territory. Mm-hmm. That still like kind of defines Daredevil. Like they'll every 5-10 years they keep going back to those kind of the same storyline. Which I don't hate, because they're the cool characters, you know.
Now you mentioned Count Dante, so I do have to ask: do you think that people like Count Dante and Ishida Kim and Frank Dukes
just about to bring
had
up
any influence on role playing, or do you think that was just like parallel with the kinds of people who were interested in RPGs were also seeing their, you know, these people's ads in the backs of comic books and stuff like that?
Yeah, I don't think they had much of an influence on RPGs, honestly. Joe Goodman is a genius for marketing Count Dante, because it anybody who sees that just immediately gets transported right back to, you know, right back to opening up the back of those comic books and seeing those ads. I know I did. But no, those guys were just kind of like the first notable McDojo sort of like like kind of like martial arts fools, you know, mm-hmm. the guys who were just kind of like, they're just out to make a quick buck. Those, there's still tons of those today, and they have been ever since. So they're just the ones that we remember because they were more or less first, you know.
Yep.
Yeah, and they had those flashy ads, you know. Like, I mean, I was like 12 years old, and I had a ninja suit for Christmas. Like, Mom, Dad, please buy me this $39.99 ninja suit out of the back of Black Belt magazine, please. And you know, I had one. I had the little boots, you know. Mm-hmm. I had some throwing stars I got down at the Army Navy surplus store. Some nunchucks I made in mm-hmm. my dad's garage. You know, I had all that stuff, man. Man. I was Mena, Arkansas's most notorious ninja.
Oh, you grew up in Mena?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
You know that's where the CIA was flying cocaine out of, right?
Oh, you don't say. No, coming from Mena, I'd never heard that before.
But, you know, martial art, whenever we talk about, like, martial arts stuff, martial arts is a huge part of kind of, I guess, my upbringing in fantasy and role playing and stuff like that. I was taught Northern style Shaolin long fist kung fu. That's a real thing.
That's a mouthful.
By a
was
guy...
there a short fist?
Say what?
Was there a short fist?
I suppose, but. I was taught by a guy who came up in like the 70s era of martial arts when the like Count Dante Dojo Storm stuff was happening.
Oh yeah.
Like fought in a couple Dojo Storms. That this kind of guy taught me martial arts. And so like I'll be watching Cobra Kai with my wife and she's like, "Where did this come from?" And I'm like, "Well, it's funny you should mention that."
Babe, how much time do you have?
In the 70s and 80s, you were expected to fight for your school.
Yeah, you look back on it now, it seems so ridiculous, but like before the internet, before you could check guy, like you could look up somebody or check them out, like someone could just move to a small town in Tennessee or Arkansas or wherever and say, "Oh, I'm a I don't know, whatever, a red sash and, you know, long fist kung fu," and then like as long as they kind of knew some moves or whatever, yeah, you might have believed them. You know, it was also foreign. Like, you just didn't know. Like, had no – it's hard to – like, unless you lived in that era, like – and you're used to not having the internet. Like, you don't realize, like, how easy it was for people to get away with lying. Yeah. You know, like people could just say something, and now you're like, that sounds like bullshit. Let me just look it up on my phone, you know. But back then, it's like, well, let's go down to the library. Let me pull out the encyclopedia. And, you know, you can't do that. You didn't do that. You just had to go, oh, all right. Yeah, I got cool. You know, people could say anything, you know.
And like Victor points out here, a lot of 80s and 90s martial arts movies were about military or CIA badasses. This is because of Frank Dukes.
Yeah.
Frank Dukes was all over the talk shows, all over Black Belt magazine, talking about how he was essentially Snake Eyes from G.I. Joe, but he could still talk. And like Levi said, it turns out Frank Dukes made up his entire life.
Yes. Yeah. And still, man, still, he clung to that to the very end.
Yeah.
Like he's still like, you know, he never came clean. Never was a moment where he was like, okay, maybe I stretched the truth on a few things. Nope. He was all in on the, you know, the secret martial arts tournaments to the death, you know, and the, 500 fights undefeated and all that ridiculous stuff. But yeah, man, thank God that those all sound more like DCC monks rather than the AD&D monks. Mm-hmm. Not that there's monks in DCC, but you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Now, as far as like other things, other topics, now that we're off the martial arts discussion, what are some of the other either macro or micro topics that you wanted to discuss?
So we did comic books, and we could listen. We could fill up like four shows of the movies, you know, whether or not they're horror movies or monster movies or just like stuff like weird sort of niche movies like Big Trouble in Little China. Like we could go all day on that kind of stuff. But some things that have that I specifically wrote down were the old like pre-regulation EC horror comics, and then. The special effects like Ray Harryhausen and Rob Bottin, Rick Baker, Stan Winston, you know, Harryhausen being the, you know, being again, being the OG old school goat. But, you know, without those old Sinbad movies, like that's that engaged a lot of people's imagination, you know, Clash of the Titans. That was another one that really just, you know, set people's minds on fire. And that dovetails into the old, you know, the mythology and you know, all that other stuff. But, you know, that stuff for sure. We could go video games. We could go music. We could go toys. You know, you can't say that, like, you know, Masters of the Universe or, like, the villains from G.I. Joe or even the bad guys from Star Wars, like Micronauts and all the stuff that's in between. Like, that stuff all had a – I know had an effect on me. And the kind of things that I like, as far as you know, in RPGs now, and if you want to get even like even more recent, what about the effects that like anime or cosplay have on modern RPGs? Because I know that like my D&D is not my oldest son's D&D. We do not have the same sources. You know, he did not come up watching the same movies that I did and being invested in the same things that I was invested in. Two completely different things, and we play the game differently. You know, that was a lot. Sorry.
Anime for gamers in my generation, anime is a big one. This definitely qualifies as fantasy, so it's probably not worth discussing on the non-fantasy episode, but Berserk is a big one for people my age. Also, just a passerby here on YouTube, it's Duan Quan, I don't remember how to pronounce that in Cantonese, but short-range boxing is the short fist that you were referring to.
Got it.
The Yangtze River in China delineates essentially the boundary between Northern style and Southern style Kung Fu. Northern style is very, the movements are very elongated. It's a lot of kicks. It's a lot of high kicks. It's a lot of going from like an elevated stance to a low stance. And then the short, the Southern style is very focused on short range techniques. Like, just a passerby pointed out there. But again, now we're off on the subject of martial arts again.
That's another, honestly, after making that Monk versus like Shaw Brothers connection, I can't stop thinking about it. You know what I mean? Like, I'm going to be thinking about that long after this episode is over.
And I mean, I guess video games as a whole is a big one for my generation. Now, I don't know. Yeah, there's a certain extent to which I think video games are a negative influence on role playing, but
100%.
As far as I guess getting people excited about the concept of a role playing game, for my generation, when you say RPG, people assume you're talking about Final Fantasy or The Elder Scrolls or you know something like that, World of Warcraft. So video games have done a lot to preserve the concept of a role-playing game for a lot of people my age and younger.
Well, I will say this. I think that video games owe RPGs far more than RPGs owe video games. You know what I mean? Like, video games probably crib a lot of their ideas from role-playing games and from the pop culture and novels and whatnot. I think we've certainly all seen it, especially in you know stuff like Skyrim or Fallout, and even like some stuff like Legend of Zelda. Like I was watching the other day, my son was playing this Zelda game, and this monster came on the screen, and it was like it was like the icy stare or the cold eye or something. I don't remember, but it was obviously a beholder. You know, it's obviously a big eye chungus. You know what I mean? Like it was a big spherical eye that was, you know, hovering above the screen, blasting down, you know, whatever. And I was like, oh yeah, that's where that came from. But you know, even like so many times you play a video game. Like you were talking about Berserk a minute ago for anime, right? Mm-hmm. You look at Berserk, like that whole look, that whole helmet, the whole nine yards, that's Phantom of the Paradise.
Yeah.
You know, Brian De Palma's Grindhouse, I wouldn't call it a Grindhouse film. It's Grindhouse adjacent. Mm-hmm. But that's a rock opera from the 70s, you know, like everything stems from everything. Everything comes from, you know, it has a toe or is dipping its beak or, you know, something in something else. So say what you want, but, you know.
And what's
video games? Sorry, go ahead.
What's funny about kind of the circular influence of role-playing games on video games, back on role-playing games, Menser Basic is translated into Japanese in 1985. And 5 years later, Final Fantasy comes out.
Yeah.
So it's pretty easy to see where that comes from.
Oh, Final Fantasy is D&D. I mean, it is just as shameless as it gets. That is Dungeons and Dragons. You have hit points. You have armor. You have shields and swords and magic spells like fire, lightning, and sleep. Like, it is D&D at its core. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no denying it.
Yep.
That's where that came from for sure.
And Paul Smith, what an esoteric reference. You've just described this entire episode.
Hey, Paul. Paul is a gem, by the way. He's the guy whose game that I'm looking forward to most playing at North Texas RPG. He's a fantastic judge, fantastic DM, and our all-around good dude. So mm-hmm. I'm watching you, Paul.
Absolutely. Let's see. Paul's running, is it Weird Frontiers?
I think he's run several different things, but I'm excited about the weird. I think, yeah, I first played in one of his Delta Green games, and then loved that. And then I played in his Weird Frontier games, and I hope he's running both, because if he is, I'm going to try to sneak in on both. Mm-hmm. But he runs all kinds of stuff, man. So, I mean, you know, he's far braver than I. That's when it comes. I run AD&D or DCC or something, but, like, mm-hmm. he's far braver than I. He'll try all kinds of weird stuff.
Absolutely.
Speaking of which, we got to get into a game together. Like,
yes, we do.
Either play one together or you run one, I run one, something. We got to get in there. We got to do this. We've talked about it for years, so mm-hmm. let's make it happen.
Yeah. I don't know, like, if you need to join one of my games or if I can sit in on one of your games or if we just need to, like, find a pickup game at the same time or something like that.
Yeah.
But we need to make that happen.
I am going to run a pickup game of Planescape. At Ooh. North Texas for a couple guys, Jason Hobbs and a couple other guys. So and it's a kind of a novel little adventure. So if the timing works out, you should jump into that one.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That'll be fun. You ever played Planescape before?
I've not played an actual like game of Planescape. I've played where people have introduced Planescape elements, but I've not played like pure classic Planescape.
Second edition. You know,
right, yeah.
Right before third edition comes around, kind of Planescape. Yeah. Mm. I want to play a game of Planescape in Zeb, where Zeb Cook runs it. You know, that would be like the ultimate for me. Mm. Like that, we've talked about this before, so I don't want to get too deep into it, but like I'm such a fan of Planescape that like just the whole idea of it is fascinating to me.
Mm-hmm. But man, you mentioned Delta Green, which brings up another. Not only does that incorporate Lovecraft, but I think for the 90s and 2000s generations, X-Files is another kind of big influence on a lot of role playing. I really feel like if you look at the games that became popular in the 90s, with even stuff like Vampire, there's a little bit of X-Files in there.
Oh, for sure. There were a lot of those games. There was like Chill and Conspiracy X. And a lot of those games that came out in the 90s that were just kind of like shooting from the hip, trying to emulate the X-Files. And Delta Green easily is the one that was the best out of all of those. Although I really liked Conspiracy X, but man, after playing in Paul's Delta Green game, I'm like, I'm all in on Delta Green. I was already a Lovecraft fan, but yeah, I definitely want to play more of that game. But yeah, X-Files for sure. Like, again, you're bringing up all this stuff that I've never really given consideration to. So that makes perfect sense. Yeah, absolutely. Catch me off guard, man.
And another kind of off the wall one, Highlander, I think is another one that a lot of people sleep on.
Oh man. How many times did I don't know about you, but I watched that like around the clock there for a couple of years. It was like always on that Queen soundtrack.
I am obsessed with Highlander, and Highlander. It's one of those series where when people ask about it, I'm just like, don't bother. Cause you've got one good movie and a decent series.
Fair.
And then a really good Queen album. And that's what you have. If you watch anything else associated with Highlander, you're in for a bad time.
You didn't like that Mario Van Peebles character? It's just terrible. Whose idea was that? Probably the same people who made Gremlins 2.
Yeah.
Just like, you know what? I know the first movie was really cool and everything worked and it's become a fan favorite. It's kind of a cult hit. But let's forget all that and do something completely different. You know, you get end up with this just terrible, terrible movie. I'm not talking about Highlander 2. I'm talking about Highlander 3.
Yeah,
you remember. Okay. Just terrible.
Highlander 2 is just like someone watched Blade Runner and then was like, hey, let's do that, but with this weird property that we have.
You know, I'm thinking back, back in the days, like in the 90s and late 80s when I was playing D&D with my friends. And there were a lot of characters who were kind of like Connor McCloud. You know, like you'd see them and like people would come up with a character and it was obviously just Connor McCloud with a different name. Kind of in the same way that like when Drizzt came out, like, you know, R.A. Salvatore's Dark Elf, suddenly there were Dark Elves that had two scimitars and, you know, or had a, you know, had a tiger or a panther or whatever, you know, or they were all of a sudden, you know, these scimitar wielding drow rangers, you know, why do we have three in the party? Like what is happening? You know, Highlander was kind of the same way on a lesser scale. It was like when Braveheart came out. There was that whole summer, there was people just playing like these kind of like Scottish or Celt or, these William Wallace type characters, you know.
A lot of Scottish dudes with French accents.
I remember the Celtic Handbook came out for AD&D kind of near that same time.
Yep.
So that was like a meeting. That movie and the game were, you know, and the source book were kind of like, oh, well, now we have a reason to play, you know, more or less, you know, a barbarian of some sort, you know, in a kilt with long hair and a greatsword. Very common.
Absolutely. But man, like the Dritz clones, you got... In this party, we have Fritz, Brits, and Shits.
Yeah, there's a fairly notable RPG artist, and I won't name him, but they were in my home group growing up, and they had, after those books came out, they had this person had a drow ranger that. His long sword suddenly turned into scimitars, and somewhere he got a figurine of wondrous power that was a panther, and I'm like, just call him Drizzt, man. Come on, we all know, nobody cares. Just call him Drizzt. I gave him a hard time about that for years.
So as we're kind of reaching the end of our time here, and this one really flew by for me. I wish we could talk for another like 2 hours about this subject, but as we're wrapping up here, is there anything that we missed that you want to cover real quick?
Well, I'll say this, like, this is a broad subject. Like, yeah. there's a lot to be said here. Like, and I'm not the authority on any of it by any stretch of the imagination. I'm just a regular role-playing dude. Like, I'm enjoying the conversation though. But if I had to throw in, I might go back to Lovecraft. You know what? Universal and Hammer Horror.
Right.
We didn't really get into that because the Universal Horror stuff is so broad, and there's so many different monsters and movies and combination of monsters and movies that I think some of that definitely informed at least the monster manual. Like, you look at the picture of the vampire, that's definitely Bela in the original monster manual. It's definitely Bela Lugosi, mm-hmm. with a little bit of flourishing. The flesh golem is definitely Frankenstein. You got the werewolf, of course, the mummy. In that first monster manual, I don't know. I'm trying to think. Like, later on, you would get the Sahagin and the Lokothal. I don't know how you pronounce it. Lokathic. I don't remember. But anyways, all those kind of deep one, sort of like flabby lip fish dudes that were obviously, you know, just takeoffs of the creature from the Black Lagoon.
Yeah.
So I think Universal Horror for sure has a place in informing at least D&D and lots of other games too. But then Hammer Horror, because Hammer Horror was like that more, it was like, hey, we're taking the stuff from Universal, but we're making it more visceral. Yep. We're making it more, you know, bloody and violent, and kind of, you know, we're adding a more deeper gothic story to it, you know, like you would have no Ravenloft without that stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Victor Gorchev makes point here in chat, Strahd is Hammer Horror.
Yeah, Victor's absolutely right.
Cleric is somewhat inspired by Peter Cushing's Van Helsing.
Boom. There you are.
As Joe says here.
Yeah, you get a lot. There's lots of references for the cleric in a lot of it in appendix, excuse me, in Appendix N. But yeah, until Joe just mentioned that, like, there is a bit of that with Peter Cushing as well. Hmm. At least one type of cleric, you know, not the armor clad, you know, mace, holy symbol, I'm a walking hospital cleric, but like the undead killer, the pursuer of evil for sure.
Even the whole concept of turn undead.
Yeah.
You get that in the Bela Lugosi Dracula when Van Helsing shows the cross, but you also get that in the Hammer Horror Dracula. And it's probably even more iconic in that one, where the way Christopher Lee reacts when Peter Cushing holds up that cross.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Those movies were a big influence on me as, like kind of in between being a kid and a teenager, you know, I'd catch those movies, on cable, but it would be like, it was like USA Up All Night, you know, yeah. kind of stuff. So it would be like, you would see it, but like you'd see like, Christopher Lee's like bloodshot, like blood filled eyes. Hmm. And there'd be like, you know, the blood dripping from the neck and stuff, but like the gorier stuff wouldn't be on TV. So I didn't see that till much later, you know, or like the like a lot of times the scantily clad, you know, victims and whatnot. I didn't get a lot of that, but seeing those movies later on, I was like, oh, these are completely, completely different movies. Like, there was a lot more going on than my 10-year-old brain remembers.
Joe Bob Briggs was hiding stuff from me.
Man, what a treasure. What a national treasure Joe Bob is. Between him and Sven Gulli, man, we're set.
Absolutely. All right. Well, unfortunately, like I said, we are at time, but fortunately, we will be back here next week, both of us again, for the second prong of the Planet X invasion. And like you said early on, we will be talking about the history of Arduin.
Well, just about how cool Arduin is. Like, yeah. I've been screaming this from the rooftops for years. Anytime anybody will let me talk about Arduin, like, I'm ready. I'm so excited. Mm-hmm. I'm ready to talk Arduin, man. Let's do it.
Absolutely. And one more time before we head home on this one, just want to remind everyone, Chainsaw Wizards, Hecatomb Creeps, and Other Ungodly Bastards is available now on Kickstarter. I will drop this here in chat one more time for everyone, and we'll talk about it again next week. But this is the latest zine from... this is a zine, right?
This is a hardback book.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it's the higher it climbs, the bigger it gets. So, I already have some friends and some guys that I've really wanted to work with for a while who are coming up with their own weird villains and strange adversaries. And I got one just the other day that blew my mind. So, like, I'm really excited to add it to the roster. There's some downright weird and bizarre, very unusual adversaries in here. But man, I'm just such a fan of weird fantasy and villains in general. Like, I was always the kid who liked like Cobra over the Joes or like Skeletor over He-Man. Like, mm-hmm. I was like the bad guys. You know, that was always the action figures I wanted as a kid, and even gravitated always towards monsters as a young monster kid. So, yeah, this all born from that. So, if you like the previous stuff I've done, this is like a pet project for me, like something I've really wanted to do for a while. So it's got a lot of Levi in it.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and you got that Adrian Landeros cover there, so you know that this is a Planet X product.
Oh, not just the cover. He has done the art for it. He's all the art in the book. So he's mm-hmm. the only artist on this book. And let me tell you, man, like, I've got like 30 of these illustrations. Like, this is just a tiny taste. Like, mm-hmm. he has done some really, really cool stuff.
Every time I think he can't do something more outrageous than what he did last time, I see a new piece by him and I'm just like, oh, damn.
Yeah, man, he's one of those guys, man, I think is just going to be, I don't know how long we're going to be able to keep him.
Yeah.
Because I think, like, you know, video games are going to swoop in and get him one day, or like, you know, the movies are going to come get him. He has a mind for like seeing, like I never have art notes for him. I'm like, I give him like one sentence, like, hey, this is the thing. And then I'll think it's going to look one way. And he comes back to me and I'm like, oh, this is 1,000 times cooler than what I had in my mind. Like, that's Adrian in a nutshell. Like, he's just awesome. Like, yeah. And a joy to work with, and talented and humble, and just, you know, I hope that I work with him for as long as I'm making books. I don't think we'll be able to keep him, but as long as we can, he's welcome. Welcome to work on basically carte blanche on anything he wants in a Planet X book. Love his style. Big fan.
Gotcha. All right. Well, guys, like I said, next week, Levi will be back and we'll be talking about Arduin. So until then, whether you rolled a 1 or a 20, I'm so glad that you rolled your bones with me, Ryan Howard, and I will see you guys next time.